This is a YUN interview with Alger Hiss on October 11, 1990, in New York City. The interviewer is Sutherland. So, Mr. Hiss, if we could continue now, after several months' break, with a few more questions to you with regard to the establishment of the United Nations. And if I might, I would like to go back to the period in the State Department, before Dumbarton Oaks even, to ask you about how the concept of enforcement developed. This was something which had been a weak point in the League of Nations, and I assume that there was much attention given to how the new organization could be stronger. But did one consider from the beginning the need to have provision for military force?
Yes, my recollection is that they did, but I think we were much too optimistic about collaboration. But one reason why I feel confident in military force was foreseen from the beginning is that this was one of the strong reasons why the veto was insisted upon, because otherwise it would mean that American forces could be called out by non-American officials, and this just wouldn't go down with the American Congress. So I think we oversimplified the idea of a military contingent that would be readily available. This is why the Joint Staff Committee seemed so important. And of course, when the Cold War began, it fell into complete disuse. So we were assuming a unanimity on enforcement.
Good. I wanted to ask about the Military Staff Committee. Did the idea of the Military Staff Committee originate on the American side?
My recollection is yes. Mm-hmm. But we're not a militaristic power. I think this was the way that... Remember, our Joint Chiefs of Military Staff were very effective during the war. And we had the combined chiefs, so we had worked with the British. And there was a model that seemed to us immediately available.
Yes.
That's why I'm quite sure we were the ones that instigated.
And in fact, it was to be consist of the chiefs of staff.
That's right, of the five permanent members.
Another question in this regard. President Roosevelt said publicly at the time, I believe, that he did not favor a world police force, that the military forces should not be seen as some kind of a world police force. Was this, well, how was it seen then in your recollection? What was it to be in your recollection?
Well, since the enforcement was only to be of Security Council decisions, that didn't make the Military Staff Committee policemen. Mm-hmm. They were enforcers of a political body. And to us, that seemed very different.
So that, in fact, the police force concept would have been more directed toward internal affairs, if you will.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's quite true. And also a more paramount position for the military, who here were simply an enforcement body for the political order.
Now, Mr. Lundquist showed me some of the charts that he had prepared at the time of Dumbarton Oaks, which showed the Military Staff Committee very prominently, almost on the same status as the ECOSOC, for example. So I judge from that that a great deal of importance was attributed to this.
That is true. And he, of course, based his illustration simply on his conversations with those of us who were working on the plans. So I think they'd be pretty authoritative, pretty
right.
Significant indications of the importance described. And my recollection is exactly the same. As I say, I think we oversimplify the problem.
Now, at Dumbarton Oaks itself, did this question of enforcement receive much attention? It doesn't seem to appear in the records very much.
No, I don't recall that it did. But remember, we did not deal with the veto.
Mm-hmm.
We left that open.
Right, that was not solved there.
It was not solved.
Later, but I think this was after the United Nations was established, there were clear differences between the Soviet side and the American side as to how this military force should be constituted, whether it should be spread around the world in different installations or it should be centralized. These questions did not come up to your recollection.
No.
That came only later.
Yeah, and my recollection is not that there were to be permanent forces assigned, but that they would be recruited as needed.
But it's in the charter, of course, that they would be designated in the national forces, that there would be units designated.
That's right.
So that was certainly the American concept then.
Exactly. But not that they would be, let's say, training together or stationed together. They were simply designated and subject to call.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, going on to San Francisco, this provision for enforcement within the concept of collective security is surely one of the less democratic aspects of the UN organization, since all countries who become members are committed to comply with the decisions of the Security Council, whereas the five members, of course, can veto it. So my question really is, was this controversial at San Francisco? Was this problem?
Oh, frightfully.
Yeah.
I should say it was the single most controversial issue. And, of course, it was the issue that Evan, as the champion of the smaller powers, made most of. And I think I've told you that I had a talk, I guess just after San Francisco, not sure which, with Walter Lippmann, who lived across the street from me, whom I knew well, and who originally opposed the veto power, as did John Dickey, who had been in the State Department.
Right.
And I convinced Lippmann that for practical political reasons, the whole Joint Staff Military Staff Committee negated any possibility of so-called world government, that the UN was not world government, but was a club of member nations. And that if the chief nations didn't choose to use it, then it would fall into disuse as any club would. But that it would never be powerful enough to compel one of the great powers to do something. Its so-called military forces would never be that strong, never were thought of as that. And smaller powers were supposed to be overawed by the concept. If you weren't, we didn't expect you were going to have military confrontation. It would be most unusual, because the smaller power would realize it had no chance.
In effect, then, the smaller powers were conscious of the fact that they were, in theory at least, giving away part of their sovereignty, whereas the major powers were not.
It never came up that they were giving up sovereignty that we weren't, it came out that it wasn't democratic.
It wasn't
fair that the big boys had more power than the smaller ones, which you're quite right, that would be. In legal terms, you could say sovereignty was infringed upon. And the whole issue of the relationship between the veto and international law, it can be looked at as a very cynical disregard of international law. In other words, if a great power violates international law, it can prevent enforcement against it by its veto. But I think we were looking at it from what we thought were the practical aspects of the only way the world could peaceably exist would be by collaboration with the great powers.
Now,
therefore, the smaller powers had much to gain from it, and they did accept it finally.
I was going to ask you, as Secretary General, what did you identify as the most difficult issue at San Francisco? Was it this issue?
I would say the veto power of the five permanent members.
And as directly related to the question of enforcement?
Definitely. Well, as related to unfairness. That even a more general proposition could be vetoed by a great power, and it couldn't by the smaller powers. So it was the issue of the big having their powers added to, instead of in an international organization having them reduced.
Now, going back to the early days in the State Department, when the planning was being done, the United Nations capacity to maintain international peace and security really is based on the concept of collective security, which
yes.
is included in the Charter.
That's right.
Was one thinking of the League of Nations in this connection? Because
expressly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very definitely. It was considered that one of the reasons the League failed was it had no powers of enforcement.
But it did have the concept of collective security.
In theory, and since it wasn't enforceable, it became phraseology rather than reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was something we wished to avoid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this did, in a sense, constitute a kind of a continuation of the League and
yeah.
its problems.
But an improvement of the League.
Right.
Though, as I've said before, it's not that we thought the League was wicked. I think I've told you that the former Irish Secretary General of the League believed that he had been discouraged from coming to San Francisco.
No, you didn't mention that now.
And I got a letter from a man who was an Irishman who was writing a biography of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said there must be some misunderstanding that we consider ourselves a development of the League, an improvement on the League. Now, it is true that for totally different reasons, in the early days of the League, and up until World War II broke out, the State Department was so afraid of the League because of the failure of the League to be adopted by the Senate, that we did not have a regular representative. We had Prentice Gilbert, who was an observer, and the League was hush-hush, but only for that reason. no real hostility to it. And in the studies for the UN, we not only drew on the League's experiences, but considered ourselves a successor to the League. Well, in fact, we were successful. We took over the buildings, took over a lot of the enforceable, the revisions, and we were regarding the work of the Assembly as promoting international law by the growth of treaties.
Now, going on to San Francisco, at the end of the San Francisco conference, Mr. Sotinius wrote a very, well, I don't know whether he wrote it, but in any event, he sent a very glowing report to President Truman, in which he actually returned to what I think of as the thinking of Immanuel Kant on peace, because he reported that now that there would be, under the Charter, free peoples with free communication, that there would not be war, because people who were free would in fact oppose involvement in war. And my question is, how broad was that thinking in San Francisco?
I think that was somewhat peculiar to Sotinius, who was a special enthusiast, who, as you know, was full of idealism. He'd been, as a student at the University of Virginia, head of the YMCA. So he was an idealist. There was, on the other hand, in San Francisco, a feeling not only of jubilation at the end of the war, but a real elation. The war then seemed so terrible in retrospect, and so clear to those who were there, that there was a temptation, a tendency to assume that this could not happen again. But looking back historically, one realizes that somewhat the same euphoria came after World War I. Look at the people who wrote pacifist material and the attitude of the young men at Oxford, the Oxford Oath. So the devastation of the war, it was almost a physical revulsion at the destructiveness of the war,
right,
the horrors that made one think mankind just won't permit this to happen again.
Was there a feeling on the American side that the wording of the Charter, in fact, would lead to the establishment of democratic governments?
Democratic governments in individual member nations.
That's right. Mm-hmm. In the Western sense.
We certainly thought that was, let's call it the wave of the future. I'm not sure I can say we thought the Charter would bring that about, but the Charter was clearly a union of free nations coming together freely.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to ask, U.S. Secretary General were also...
Let me interrupt.
Sure.
Once more there. There was a feeling that the Russians would be more accommodating in regard to Eastern Europe than later proved to be the case. And I'm sure you've read some of the recent academic studies of that. The new edition of Gerhard Perowitz's book.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
I've seen it, yes. But, yeah.
Well, you know, he has quotations from Burns' diary and from Truman's diary, which show hostility to the Soviet Union, which he believed led the Soviets to fear either a preventive strike or something of that sort. And the tendency toward freedom, which we had sensed at Yalta, and which the survivals of at San Francisco were snuffed out by that. So it's hard to see the spirit, which is still part of, I called it euphoria, but that's a slightly condescending word. The spirit of elation is better. Mm-hmm. So I do think we expected something like the world of today.
Did you detect the first signs of estrangement between East and West already at San Francisco?
Oh, even before.
Even before.
Yes, I assume I told you. Stettinius was horrified when he got the report from Truman about the meeting with Molotov. Mm. He had thought the whole conference might collapse if Molotov had refused to go on to San Francisco. So we definitely realized that Truman was taking a censorious attitude.
And the issue there was Poland, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
So that, in a sense, Poland was the first real indication then, the controversy of Poland, which did spread to San Francisco.
Very definitely.
Yeah, as the first real indication.
Right. But then, you see, it had expression in various ways. Argentina, and what Nelson Rockefeller helped pull off there, which the Russians quite naturally thought was official on our part. We just couldn't imagine somebody running off independently and doing.
And Ambassador Rostchin, a Soviet official.
Yes, I remember the name now. Rostchin.
Right.
Rostchin.
Right, exactly. He has indicated that Stalin originally decided that Molotov should not go to San Francisco for three reasons. And one of them was a sense in Moscow that the United States had backed down on the understanding reached at Yalta on membership by the Ukraine and Byelorussia in the United Nations, separate memberships for them. Was this evident in San Francisco?
Well, you know that at Yalta, that had occurred by accident.
Right, right.
And well, I've always thought if that particular accident hadn't occurred, we would have come to accept it begrudgingly. It must have been plain to Stalin that this was something. See, he thought from what he was told at that meeting, surprise meeting with Roosevelt, Stettinius, that we had agreed to it. But he must have soon realized, since in the communique, we didn't just include them as regular new members. We said we would support them. And that was kept quiet, was not put in the communique. It was and then that leaked out, and there came the attacks on Yalta as having secret agreements. And this was the only secret one in the political sphere that I knew of. But all of that must have made it plain to Stalin that this was not something the U.S. was very pleased with, but that he thought we would engage on it. No, this I had not heard before, but it must have, what you're saying is that it colored the Russian approach.
That's right. It was apparently a conversation which the Soviet ambassador in Washington had with the then Under Secretary of State, who frankly, who actually was not informed. And so he professed to, quite honestly, to know nothing about any such agreement.
Oh,
and that was reported back to Moscow, and in a sense misinterpreted, because it was simply a matter of ignorance, which the Russians now recognize. I mean, at least Ambassador Rostov did.
Yeah, but at the same time, it fitted in with the fact that the U.S. wasn't happy.
Exactly. Now, I wanted to ask, you've mentioned before that you were both Secretary General, but also a member almost of the U.S. delegation in San Francisco. And I wanted, in that connection, to ask, during the meetings of the commissions and the committees, which were concerned with the substantive questions of the Charter, did you participate in the substantive discussions, and if so, in which capacity?
No. I never participated as a representative of the U.S. any time I took part in the Charter process. It was as an international civil servant.
Mm-hmm. But did that involve you in a discussion of the substance, or was it a matter of keeping the delegates straight, so to speak, in their understanding of what's
going on? I tried to restrict myself to the latter, and allow the individual delegations to hammer out the agreement.
Right. Right. Very often, at present, the Secretariat at the United Nations, of course, theoretically conducts itself that way, but has to really formulate paragraphs and resolutions and so forth as a matter of assistance to the delegation.
To illustrate the point we're talking about, I certainly made no secret in talking to Evett, for example, that I thought his position was wrong, that he'd never get a charter on that basis. And I would argue with him what was really the position of all the great powers, but from the point of view of someone who cared deeply for formation of the United Nations. So I was still speaking, I believe, as a civil, as an international civil servant.
Right, right. I really just have one more question. And that has to do with the Charter itself as a document, because I was told by Mr. Lundquist that when the Charter was signed, you had the responsibility of carrying it back to Washington. How did you do this? How could you describe how this was done?
It was decided that there was no proper, let's call it receptacle, place of safekeeping for the Charter. The UN hadn't come into existence. Where the Secretariat would be disbanded. And it was agreed that Truman would keep it in the White House safe. And that since the US had been the host, this would be appropriate. And I was therefore deputed to carry the Charter to the White House and deliver it to him for that kind of safekeeping. And the Army put a plane at my disposal for that purpose. And the humorous aspect of it was that since the Charter was so valuable, it had a parachute attached to it, and I didn't attach to me. But, of course, I'm sure the answer was, if I'd had to jump, maybe they would give me a parachute then. But the humor was that the charter actually had a parachute. So when I arrived in Washington, I immediately went to the White House with the charter and told the doorman who answered the door that I had something I had to present personally to the president. He conferred and came back, and I was permitted to come in the presence. And the president had arrived back from some trip he made. Maybe it was, he had also been in San Francisco. But Mrs. Truman was not in the White House at the time. And he and his aides were sitting around